Vipassana on the 20th of January 1976. The Dhamma of the Lord Buddha was expounded correctly and properly. It was not hidden or obscure, but was presented according to the truth, existing on every level of Dhamma. It proclaims, for example, that virtue and vice, hell, heaven, and Nibbana really do exist. That kilesas are true, that they are real, and that they prevail just like the other more apparent things. There are no contradictions. So why are there these things a problem for us? The Dhamma was openly presented. There was nothing esoteric and mystical about it. It was expounded entirely in accordance with truth, the facts that actually exist. It was presented on every level of truth, and yet we cannot understand it. It is as if the Lord is saying, "Look here, look at this," to the blind and deaf. Apparently, we are like the blind who can grope but cannot see. Wherever we go, we always bump into dukkha. Although the Lord already told us what dukkha was like, though we might understand it, we still keep running into it. He told us that dukkha is harmful, but we are constantly caught by it because our motives and the way we follow them are entirely for the amassing of dukkha, which only burns us. Concerning the virtue of Dhamma, the Lord has shown that it is sandittiko, visible here and now. Sukha and dukkha can both be seen and experienced within ourselves. Death, for example, it is also ehipasiko and opanayiko, very important principles. Ehipasiko means calling us to come and see the truthful Dhamma. It is not for us to beckon others to come and see the truthful Dhamma. Ehi means teaching the person himself. Who listens to Dhamma and then practices it, to turn his heart round and look right here, where the truth is. In worldly terms, the truth is constantly proclaiming itself, constantly inviting and challenging. Because of its veracity, it challenges us to look here. Ehi means look here. It doesn't mean we should call others to come and look. How could they see when they don't look and have never known the truth? The truth is in themselves. But if they do not look at it or know it, how can they come and see the truth within us? Ehi pasigo, the Lord taught us to look at the truth about ourselves, which is right here. Opanayiko means to bring within. Whatever we see or hear or touch, we should bring inside and make good use of. Whatever comes into contact with the eyes, ears, nose, tongue and body, or appears in the heart, must all be open ego, brought inward. Whether it is concerned with virtue or immorality, whether satisfactory or not, internal or external, past or future, it is all open ego, drawing into the heart, which is the principal cause of all internal affairs. The citta is preeminent. Nothing surpasses the citta in importance. The business of the citta is therefore extremely pressing and imperative. Mano bhubbang kamma dhamma. All dhammas originate from the heart. Just this much is enough to shake the entire physical world. Even the slightest motion must originate in the heart. All dhammas have the heart as their basis. Nothing but the heart can discern all the various phenomena. Nothing else is capable of this. What are the various kinds of dhamma? Where are the kusala, wholesome dhamma, and the akusala, unwholesome dhamma, if not in the heart? The kusala dhamma arises due to the ingenuity of the heart. It nurtures the heart with wisdom and enables it to cope wisely with all the various events that arise out of our ignorance, though we may be totally unaware. Akusala dhamma also arises in the heart. We must use the kusala dhamma, which is the way of panya, investigating and correcting our ignorance, which we call akusala dhamma, so that we can totally eliminate it from the heart. Opana yiko means drawing inward. We must draw the wisdom of foolishness of others, whoever they might be, into ourselves. The Lord taught us to bring it inward. Ehi patsigo is to look right here at the origin of all causation, the heart, which is in a perpetual state of activity. This activity is much more incessant than any machinery which only operates according to its time schedule. The heart is never shut down, but goes on until the last day of life. And because it never ceases, we grumble and complain that it is dukkha. But no matter how much we snivel, it is of no practical value, because we are not rectifying it at the root cause. This is where the remedy should be applied. When we have corrected the cause, dukkha will gradually cease in proportion to our ability, our wise judgment, and our circumspect wisdom. Thus, the Lord never taught about other things, because it would be teaching one to chase after shadows, like saying, "Look over there, look over there," which is just looking away from the real culprit, the original cause. Of paramount importance is to teach the principal cause, because that is where the kilesas originate. What are we going to do? How are we going to cope? What is the origin of dukkha and the hardship which all beings must suffer? What is the origin of birth, aging, illness, and death? These are caused by the kilesas, which are the source and the prime mover. Why could they arise other than in the heart? They are right here. And that's why the Lord didn't teach about other places. Why do we seriously investigate the principle of reason, cause and effects, so as to gradually see the truth and steadily uproot the kilesa? We must do it here. This is where we bind ourselves and accumulate the kilesa because of our ignorance and stupidity. And so, when we uproot the kilesa with the means of satipanya, mindfulness and wisdom, which increase in their depth and discernment, we must also do that here. We have to maintain mindfulness at this place. This is the spot at which we must be extremely careful and vigilant. This is the point which we must closely protect and support. The point is the heart. This is what we nourish with mindfulness, with the practice of bhavana, mind development. We can increase our present mindfulness by careful cultivation. Protect it well. We must not allow this citta to go out and become involved with the external affairs, and to then bring them back to burn ourselves with. This is the protection. Eradication comes by probing and reasoning into the basis of truth. Whatever is detrimental, we must try and correct with reason and analysis into its fundamental nature, so that we can put it right at the point where it arises and gradually ceases. The true principal culprit is the citta. It is the citta that takes up birth and ceaselessly wanders in samsaravata, the cycle of birth and death, for an unaccountable length of time. The accumulated corpses, through repeated birth and death, of just one person, are enough to fill the whole world. But we can neither comprehend or account for them. They are beyond reckoning. We don't know how to add it all up, because of our blinding ignorance, which totally conceals all the truth about ourselves. What remains is just deception and delusion, where no essence of truth can be found. The Lord therefore taught to correct it here. We should try to develop well our mindfulness so that it can catch up with our thoughts and imaginings. They are conceived in the citta, and then agitate it constantly. Given that we already have mindfulness, as soon as there is the slightest rippling of the citta, when it begins to conceive, both sati and panya will also in turn be aroused simultaneously. As we sit and watch right at the place where all the developments originate, right at the heart, we will notice it as soon as it begins to set in motion. We will then gradually see it. Truly, this is where the deception of the citta takes place. The way the citta can understand the truth is by the means of panya. We must investigate into the nature of the dhatu khanda, the body, until the truth of it is fully embedded in the citta. This is when the truth about each different part of the body becomes distinctly clear within the citta. We must investigate many, many times, and then we will be fully impressed. Each time we investigate, we will learn and understand more. Until with many repetitions, this understanding will accumulate and become extremely profound, and we become totally convinced. Rupa, form, listen. What is rupa? Hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, and bones are all rupa. This includes every internal part and organ, which are on the physical and material side. The Lord called this the form aggregate, or simply the body. All right, look here. While exploring and probing, we must have sati, following our perception of any part or organ of the body. Let sati direct the work of investigation, and panya screen it. As the knowingness is aware of the body, panya should correspondingly screen the information for true understanding, and sati should constantly acknowledge. This is our work. We have done enough of the work of drifting and wandering, of thinking and imagining without sati. They have been enormously harmful to our heart and afflicted it severely. This sort of thinking and imagining has been of no benefit or practical value to us. But this other work is the way of totally uprooting the dukkha and peril that are within ourselves. This work should be carried on with sati directing, with panya doing the work of reflection and reasoning, and with the knowingness following the cognition of each bodily condition. By taking each particular condition as a guideline for the heart to follow, sati panya must constantly follow closely, as the writing follows the root line. Sati must be constantly supporting and observing. This is the Gammatthana sightseeing trip to the cemetery found within ourselves. We must not let over eagerness for a speedy realization, following our heart's desire, take over the truth under investigation. Keep our understanding to what we have already comprehended, and continually keep on with our contemplation. We just want to differentiate and penetrate into the nature of the khanda, which is merely covered with a thin membrane of skin that deceives the eyes of the world and every one of us. It's not even as thick as a palm leaf. That's the skin. Whichever way we investigate will always be for the overcoming of our delusion, and can also be rather absorbing. All right. Let's look up to the top and down to the bottom, and outside and inside the body. Let's become engrossed in this sightseeing trip. Don't merely go along, but have sati follow right behind, and panya to scrutinize the perception of each particular part of the body. When looking up or down, or at any part, will always be in accordance with the Sacca Dhamma. This is exerting to the utmost. This exertion is the work of removing and eradicating the poison of upadana, attachment, that possesses and clings to every part of the body. This is the reason why dukkha is everywhere. It is this upadana which is the principal culprit. This universal dukkha refers to the dukkha in the heart, caused by attachment, and not the dukkha of the body. As for bodily dukkha, which arises due to illness, the Lord Buddha and the Savaka also had to experience it, because the khanda fall under the law of anicchang, dukkang, and anatta, and must obey it. But the citta that has transcended anicchang, dukkang, and anatta, or is in a position to do so, must investigate these things so that it will not be affected through being unmindful. This is because the visualizing of what one is foreseeing the truth. It is of paramount importance and will prevent all things from affecting the heart. In other words, this will keep dukkha from arising within ourselves, caused by our fabricating, imagining, and our fantasy that the body is ourselves and belongs to us. Investigate it. Probe right into it. All right. What is the nature of skin? What about those animal hides that are made into handbags and shoes? All right, let's look at the whole lot. The flesh, sinews, and bone. Look, both animal flesh and human flesh are alike. Look into it. What's the nature of bone? What's the difference between animal and human bone? Look right at the complete truth within ourselves. Keep on looking. Just look at this body, which is the object that is inherently inviting and challenging. Why can't our heart comprehend it? Why isn't it bold and courageous? Once we merely have seen the truth, this is enough to begin challenging the deception. The truth, realized with panya, is extremely powerful and capable of gradually wiping out those factitious and false views until they are entirely eliminated. The truth that appears within the heart can arise by means of satipanya. This truth is valid in two respects. In one respect, all the truth of rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara, and vijnana are real. Their very existence is a challenge itself. When panya has fathomed and realized the truth of these conditions, it will then become the truth within the heart. Such is the way of uprooting the kilesa. Once these two truths merge, they are no longer harmful, but are capable of totally eradicating all the poison and peril out of the heart. While we were on the Gamatana sightseeing tour of the body, we have examined and contemplated its various organs, both large and small. Now we must continue with this Gamatana trip to see how this body ends in transformation and dissolution. we must fix our attention at this place to see in what way it will decay and rot away until it's completely disintegrated and dispersed. The body must definitely go this way. Though the method we use to fix our attention can vary following our own inclination and preference. Suppose that we wish to fix our attention at a particular object so as to clearly see it within the citta. Whatever object we take, skin, for instance, must be firmly held so that it appears in the field of perception. We must make that image appear in the citta, with sati pinpointing and concentrating at that point. All right, whether that image appears high or low, we must not speculate on its position. The object under investigation must be taken as the most important target to set our awareness on, and with sati directing. All right, should that object undergo any change, let it be clearly perceived right here and now, at the time of the investigation. Whether high or low, let us just be aware that it is so. Don't imagine or construe that is too high or too low or has already left the body. At first, we think we are investigating inside the body. This particular object is supposed to be inside the body. Yet, why is it now outside? We must not think like that. If we don't let go of our awareness, which is being focused on the target of our investigation, even if it may be high or low, inside or outside, we will come to experience the unusual and marvel from that object. For instance, if we concentrate on flesh, be it of any part of the body, we must do it so as to see it clearly within ourselves. Then it will gradually transform and break apart. With sati firmly established, which is when we have undivided attention firmly fixed in front of us, the citta will know that it is doing the work and that panya is doing the analysis. In a short while, that object begins to transform. Namely, it begins to decay and decompose. All right, let's get to see it very clearly, without fear of death. We are looking at the truth and not our own demise. All right, disintegrate. This was how I investigated. Each of the different parts just broke up. It was really absorbing doing this investigation. This investigation of one's own body. Yet, while being absorbed in the investigation, it seemed that the body had completely vanished. The awareness of the body was not apparent, even though one was investigating the body. All right, the body decomposes. The head falls off. An arm breaks off, right in front of our eyes. Then the other arm, and a piece of bone, and everything inside ruptures and bursts out. All right, keep on looking. Keep absorbed with this perception. It keeps on breaking up. Some of the liquids seep into the ground, and some evaporate into the air. That's the way it goes. Some of the fluids percolate into the ground, and some escaping into the atmosphere. Once all the liquids have either permeated into the ground or vanished into the air, the body parts become dried out. They steadily dehydrate until they finally turn into earth. Then both the earth and the bones of the body merge and coalesce together, becoming one and the same substance. One sees it clearly. The more solid parts, like the bone, for instance, could then be gradually concentrated upon, sometimes burning them with fire, or letting them slowly decompose and crumble, until one can vividly see that they have completely merged with the earth, becoming one with it. In this investigation, the earth and water elements appeared the most distinct, but the earth element was especially profound and impressive to the heart. The water elements appear just as water, and both the air and fire elements didn't pose as a problem. They were not the weighty objects of investigation, and didn't appear so profoundly within the heart, as did the investigation of the body, which is rather a gross object. Once they had entirely disintegrated and dispersed into the earth, the citta became peaceful and tranquil. Everything at that moment became serene and at peace. This can happen. But while doing the investigation, don't speculate or fantasize. One should only take the truth within oneself as one's possession and as one's living testimony. Don't take the speculation and fantasy as one's evidence and mode of practice, for they are others' possessions and do not belong to us. Our own possessions are what we have realized by ourselves, and whatever they are, let them happen within ourselves. In other words, let our genuine possession be what we have realized and experienced for ourselves. Such is the way we should practice. At other times, the results were not always like this, though they still happen following the principle of nature. When the body has disintegrated and dispersed into the earth, there were still left some skeleton parts in a partial state of decomposition. Then an anticipation appeared in the heart, predicting that even these remains would also eventually turn to earth. So even though at that time there was absolutely no awareness of the body, there was still some thinking and conceiving in the citta. But the citta did somehow conceive. Then shortly after that, the ground suddenly swelled up out of nowhere and swallowed up the rest of the remains, transforming them all into earth. When all of the skeletal remains had completely turned into earth, the citta, for some unknown reason, reacted in another way and caused all of them to disappear. The ground that previously had suddenly swelled and swallowed the partial decomposed skeletal remains, transforming them all into earth, was no longer evident. Then the knowledge and realization arose that every part of the entire body is made of earth, and that they had all returned to the earth. A few moments later, The citta again reacted in a mysterious way, and all the earth simply vanished. Everything disappeared. All that remained was pure awareness. It was then completely empty, and there arose an indescribable feeling of wonder and amazement. Because this kind of result from the investigation had never happened before. But now it had actually happened, and had been vividly perceived and experienced. The citta then remained in the state of singularity, without a single moment of duality, because it was truly in an absolute state of oneness. As soon as the citta begins to stir, there would be duality with the thought process. But here, there was absolutely no thought process. There was only the awareness of merely being aware, and it was a transcendingly marvelous state of awareness. During that time, everything was perfectly serene and at peace, and totally empty, completely devoid of the physical world. No trees, no mountains, nothing. It could probably be said that they had all turned into space. But then again, the one who experienced this did not construe them to be so. Only the knowingness was there. That's all that can be said. The citta remained for many hours in this state of calm, and having come out, everything still remained serene and at peace, even when any particular object was fixed upon. This kind of experience probably happens just this once for each practitioner. Personally, it has only happened to me once and has never occurred again. But even so, one can still investigate into the basis of truth, according to the skill of the citta, until one succeeds every time. The transformation process into earth, water, air, and fire is vividly distinct every time one investigates it. This kind of experience is capable of strengthening the citta, making it well acquainted with the truth, the genuine earth, water, air, and fire, as well as being capable of gradually uprooting the view of I and mine. For in truth, we should consider the body as the element, or as the earth element, for it is precisely so. It is not I or mine, following the various opinions and imaginings. By repeatedly investigating and then continually understanding, constantly and perpetually keeping this going, the profundity of one's understanding will steadily deepen until one clearly comprehends and detaches oneself from the view of body as I and mine. Then there will be merely the body, and if you call it body, it is merely a label. We could also call it a phenomenon, if we like. Once the citta has sufficiently understood, nothing can pose a problem. Whatever the heart may call it, it can pose a problem, because the problem is solely within the heart. It is therefore necessary to correct our problems by disengaging ourselves from our delusion and fantasy, and by entering into the truth of Dhamma, the pure awareness. Externally, they are merely elements, though we might suppose them to be body. They are really the elements, plain and simple elements. Returning to the citta, it is purely citta. Both of them are the truth, the all-embracing truth. All right, Chudvetana, feeling, appear, let it do so, for it is also a variety of element, or a form of Sapava Dhamma, natural processes, similar to the body. This is how they are related. Sanya is notion. As soon as concocting begins, we would realize that this originates from the citta, fabricating and forming opinions. When we understand this, the citta will disengage and sanya immediately cease. But if we are not aware of this, it will continue on in succession, like a chain reaction. When we become aware of this, it will stop at the moment when sati catches up with it. It would then cease to concoct concepts and associations of ideas. This is what is meant by sati being upward. If it can't catch up with it, then the train of thoughts will perpetually go on and on. The investigation of the body should be of the greatest concern. The Lord therefore taught the four satipatthana, four foundations of mindfulness, which is completely found within this body and citta. The Sacca Dhamma, truthful Dhamma, is also found here. The Lord taught them with regard to this place, that is to say, with regard to the citta. What is the purpose of all these investigations? They are for the purpose of making the citta realize and comprehend according to truth, so that it can then relinquish its deluded attachment to the view of self. All right, when we have completely eliminated our false belief in the four elements, earth, water, air, and fire, as well as that of vetana, sanya, sankhara, and vijnana, feeling, memory, thoughts, and sense awareness, which make up the five khanda, aggregates, we must then investigate the delusion of the citta. See, it's still a problem. This level of delusion is insidious due to the subtle nature of its kilesa. And this is the subtle misconception of the citta. We must move in closer and investigate. What do we use as the basis for this investigation? We are investigating the citta. And the citta is nama dhamma, incorporeal. And so is vetana, and the kilesa, and panya. It is not only the citta that is nama dhamma. Any nama dhammas can coexist and interrelate. And since the kilesa and the citta are nama dhamma, they can associate together. All right. Panya must therefore do the searching, for it is also nama dhamma. We must investigate in the same way as we did with the body, vetana, sanya, sankhara, and vijnana. And about the body, vetana, sanya, sankhara, and vijnana. It knows everything about them. But the problem is that it doesn't know itself. This is where it gets stuck. This is where it is ignorant. We must now turn panya into the citta, dissecting and cutting it so as to penetrate it. We must thrust through to that knowingness, which is the conceited awareness and the real delusion of the citta. After careful and thorough scrutiny and analysis of the condition that is diffused within the citta, it would become just another sapava dhamma, natural process. All right, if the citta is ruined by the investigation, let it be so. Don't cherish and cling to it. If the citta stands up to the truth, it will remain and won't disintegrate. If it stands up to its true nature, it will be free from the corruptions and will arrive at the state of purity. Let's see whether the citta will be annihilated or not. Dig into it. Don't cherish anything, not even the citta. Don't be afraid that the citta will be destroyed or dispersed or vanished. Once Panya has completely wiped out the infiltrators, every kind of kilesa will disappear, for they are all the falsity existing within the citta. When the investigation really gets moving properly, those things that are vulnerable to dispersion will not be able to withstand and will disintegrate. But the nature that cannot be annihilated under any circumstances will always remain. How could this citta disappear? Please notice, therefore, that it is the citta that is dominated by the kilesa. Once Panya has totally shattered and cleared the kilesa away, the citta will be transformed into the state of purity. This is the genuine purity. How can it vanish? Were it to disappear, how could it be pure? That one dissolves. That one disintegrates. But this one is the genuine Amatang, the undying, immortal by way of purity. This is not the Anijang that spins with the Vatajaka, the revolving wheel of birth and death. The other is called the undying, but it also whirls with the Vatajaka. But this Amatang is undying and does not revolve. It is Vivatta, undying and non-revolving. This is the real and true substance, or essence, which is in the midst of our khanda. This is indeed the main culprit, the one that incites and it agitates the citta, fooling it to be deluded by the world and the dhatu, the elements, by the khanda and the various vedana, and by pain, illness, confusion, and madness. In truth, these things voice no opinions. Whatever the body is, that's what it is. When vedana arise, they do so in their natural way. They don't know that they are vedana, or that they are dukkha, or sukha, or neutral, or whatever. It is this citta that forms the opinions and ideas about them, and then falls for its own opinions and ideas, gaining no benefit, but only afflicting itself with much harm. We must therefore investigate them with panya, to see according to their true nature. What will then disintegrate? What have we got to lose? If the body should break, let it break. It is anicang, dukkang, and anatta, as the Lord always said. This Dhamma reign over the entire physical world, so why shouldn't they rule over the khanda? If it falls under the law of anicang, dukkang, and anatta, how can we interfere? Let go of it. If it can't withstand, let it break. Everything in this physical world is breaking and dissolving. Some sooner, others later. But surely, our khanda can last for eons and eons, for they fall under the same law and limit. So let's investigate to see according to truth before they break up. This is circumspect panya. Let's get to comprehend clearly when dukkha vedana appears. All right. Today we climb into the ring. That's it. Today we are going into the ring in order to see and realize the truth in accordance with the principle of Dhamma and not to fail and go under. You see, when dukkha vedana arises, it's dukkha vedana's business. And the investigation of dukkha vedana, which is in the khanda, is the business of sati panya. We want to find out the truth from this investigation. So how can we be obliterated? We neither do it for our downfall, nor our own destruction, but we do it for victory, and for the penetrative discernment, and all-embracing realization of every aspect of truth within our heart. Then we will be free from these things. And this is the highest blessing. The Lord said that Nibbana Sacchi Giriyaja Etamang Kalamuttamang. The realization of Nibbana is the highest blessing. This is the way for the realization of Nibbana. This is the way to do it. Nibbana is concealed because the citta is being covered and totally obscured by the kilesa, tanha, and avicca, defilements, cravings, and ignorance. We must therefore remedy this by the method of investigation and analysis to see in accordance with the truth. This is the way of revealing and uncovering all the things that have been hidden. It is called the way of realizing Nibbana and seeing it clearly within the heart. Once it's clearly perceived, it will be etamang kalamuttamang, the highest blessing. What can be any higher than Nibbana Sacchi Kiriya? This is really the highest. From here on, it is puttassa lokatammehi cittang yassa nakampati asokang virachang kemang etamang kalamuttamang. Whatever comes into contact with the citta, it is no longer shaken or disturbed. Nothing can reach it or affect it. Then what can be said but kemang? The Lord said that this is the secure and blissful citta. It is the highest blessing. These two blessings mentioned here are in the heart and nowhere else. It is the heart that is the blessing, yet it is also a curse under the same guise. Right at this moment, we are turning the curse that has infiltrated our hearts into the blessing. Nibbana Sacchi Kiriya. All right, let's remedy it. Let's unravel it. Tapoja Brahmacharyanja Ariya Sacchana Datsanam. Here, tapo means the incineration of the kilesa. The fiery kilesa sear the citta. So we must incinerate them with this tapo, conflagrant dhamma, which is sati, panya. It's an affliction to the kilesa, which scorches and burns it. Ariya Sacca Nadatsanam means the realization of the Ariya Sacca, the Four Noble Truths. Dukkha is now fully understood within the citta, and Samudaya, the cause of dukkha, is completely relinquished. Magga, the path, is fully developed to its ultimate level of Mahasati and Mahapanya, great mindfulness and great wisdom. What else is left to say? Nirodha, the total cessation of dukkha, has appeared. This is the way of seeing the Sacca Dhamma, truthful Dhamma. The one who truly sees and completely realizes the Sacca Dhamma is the one who has realized Nibbana and is no longer shaken by all the Loka Dhamma, worldly Dhamma. This one is the citta. We must try to seize this fundamental essence. The citta is of paramount importance. We have already investigated and dealt with the body and everything within the five khanda. All we have to do now is to catch this one, which is the principal culprit. If anything should break, let it break. That is the way of this world, and has been like that from time immemorial. We have undergone repeated births and deaths for eons and eons, and we are still going down the same road we have gone down before. This road is the way of nature. No one can interfere with it, but must follow it. We already have an inkling of the truth of nature's way. What are we going to do now? The wisdom in this explanation ends here. Please take it all up for consideration and for meditating upon, and don't remain heedless and complacent. Nibbana sacci kiriyaca etamang kalamuttamang. The endeavoring for the realization of Nibbana is the highest blessing, must one day definitely be the possession of those Buddhist followers who relentlessly strive and exert themselves. May this exhortation now come to a close.
Sina, the Arahant's Citta.
Panajan Man said, the heart has only one universal language. Regardless of language or nationality, there is only one knowing, and that is the heart. As soon as we bring something to mind, we can understand it right away. But when we have to speak it out, then it has to be put into this or that language, and then it is more difficult to understand. But our awarenesses in the citta are all identical. Dhamma and the heart are therefore a perfect match. Dhamma is the language of nothing but the heart. It stays with the heart. Both sukha and dukkha are in the heart. It is the heart which generates them by virtue of its own thinking. This sukha and dukkha are the result of this thinking, and the heart must experience and bear them. Both the heart and Dhamma are perfectly suited to each other, regardless of nationality or speech. If it accords with Dhamma, it is always compatible with the heart, and both the heart and Dhamma are right and fitting for each other. The heart is the core within our body, the fundamental and substantial part, an important essence. Such is the heart, and it is preeminent. The conditions arising from the heart, like thought and imaginings, all rise and cease like ripples. The heart stirs itself up when it thinks and imagines. Sanya is perception, imagination, and memory. When a thought is long and extended, it is sanya. When it is short and momentary, it is sankhara. Sanya is perception, memory. Vijnana is the acknowledgement of the contact between the sense objects and the sense organs. For example, when a form contacts the eyes, there arises an awareness of this contact. All of them continually arise and cease, for this is their inherent nature. The Lord referred to them as the khandhas, groups or categories. These five khandhas continually arise and cease. All the arahants have khandhas, just like ordinary people, with the difference that their khandhas are pure and free from the domineering kilesas, which direct the heart to think and imagine. Their khandhas think naturally and freely. This type of citta is not manipulated to think and imagine, like the citta of ordinary people. Speaking comparatively, the khandhas of ordinary people are like those of a prisoner, who is continually controlled and manipulated. All his thoughts, imaginings, and perceptions are manipulated. They are being directed to think about this or imagine about that, or to perceive in this or that fashion. In other words, the kilesas are the master that manipulate the khandhas to function. This is not true for the arahants. When they imagine, they do it naturally. As soon as they imagine, this imagination ceases right away. There is no agent to keep the citta going, and no agent to weigh it down. There is nothing to control it, in contrast to the khandhas under the sway of the kilesa, and have the kilesas as their master. So in this respect, the cittas are different, although their true natures are all the same. All the above mentioned are anicjang, impermanent. Changeability is inherent in each and every khanda, namely the rupa khanda, which is our body, and the vedana khanda, which comprises sukha, dukkha, and neutral feelings. They all continually rise and cease, as do sanya, sankhara, and vijnana. Their inherent nature is to continually rise and cease. On the other hand, the true knowing, which is the basis of our awareness of the things that rise and cease, does not itself cease. It is impossible for us to say that the citta ceases or that the citta rises. Consequently, a purified citta is totally rid of both the issue of birth and death, and also the dhatu and the khanda. A purified citta does not take birth in the various realms of existence, nor does it manifest itself in any physical form, such as an animal or person. But for those people whose cittas are not purified, they will continue taking on birth and death, and will keep on heading for the cemetery. And it is all due to this undying citta. Therefore the Lord Buddha taught Dhamma to the world, especially the world of humans, because we are the ones capable of knowing about good and evil, about what is wholesome and unwholesome, about what is beneficial and harmful, and about the way of correction, alteration, and cultivation. We are the ones who can comprehend the language that he used to teach the Dhamma. Therefore, teaching the human world was the first priority and took precedence over the other world, so that we may try to modify and correct the things that we see to be useless and harmful, and remove them from our heart, body, and speech. He also taught us to develop and cultivate goodness, to promote the growth of existing virtue, and to bring about new wholesome states. We are to keep on maintaining and nourishing the good already accumulated, to use this to nurture the heart, to provide it with coolness, peace, and happiness, to equip it with a basis of Dhamma and goodness. Should it depart from the existing dhatu khanda and go on to a different birth and existence, the citta that is constantly being nourished by good and virtue will be a good citta. It will proceed to a good state. And if it is born again, it will go to a good birth. live a good life, always be happy, and eventually be able to transcend the wheel of existence. This is made possible by the support of its faculty, power, potential, and virtue, all gradually and continually built up in the past. For example, yesterday is today's past. Today is tomorrow's past. They all are days which we spent developing wholesome states that will powerfully strengthen and support the citta, which will eventually pass beyond. Samuti is birth and death, and covers even the most subtle and tranquil realms of existence. Those who have absolutely passed beyond the realm of rebirth, like the cittas of the Arahants and the Lord Buddha, are devoid of samuti. Concerning this subject, there is the story of the Venerable Wangisa. Ever since he had been a layman, he was an expert in seeing the cittas of the dead and where they may have ended up. He could do it with the citta of anybody. I wouldn't really call him a fortune teller, more just an expert in the occult. When people brought the skull of a departed one to him, he would tap on it a few times. He would then concentrate his mind and would know the rebirth of this particular citta. He could tell if it was reborn as a being in hell, or went to heaven, or was born subhuman as a preta, or as a ghost. He could tell it all, as long as he was given the skull of the deceased. When he heard from his friends that the Lord Buddha was much more accomplished than himself, he became interested in acquiring more knowledge, and so went to see the Lord Buddha to learn more about his branch of knowledge. When he met the Lord Buddha, he was given the skull of an arahant and was told, "Try this, see where this one has gone." He tapped and listened, but there was silence. Again he tapped and listened. Again there was silence. He meditated on it, but still, silence. Contemplated again, still, silence. He was unable to discern where the former possessor of this skull had gone to. When he was at the end of his wits, he frankly confessed, "I really don't know where this one has gone to." At the outset, the Venerable Wangisa thought himself brilliant and clever, and so he went to challenge the Lord Buddha. This was before becoming his disciple. He was given the skull of an arahant to do his tapping, and at this point, he got stuck. He now wanted to take up the learning, because now he could become incredibly great. As it happened, he asked the Lord Buddha to be his teacher. Thus the Lord Buddha taught him the knowledge and the way, namely the knowledge of Dhamma. He then constantly practiced and developed until he attained his goal and became an arahant. Thereafter, he was no longer interested in tapping anyone's skull apart from his own. When he knew clearly and penetratively, he was rid of all problems. This is the correct way to tap a head. Here we are referring to the citta which doesn't take rebirth. Despite his expertise, the Venerable Wangisa was unable to know where a purified one had gone to take up new birth. A purified citta has no rebirth. Consider the Venerable Gaudika, here is another valuable lesson. When he was cultivating Dhamma, his practice kept on fluctuating, advancing, and deteriorating again and again for about half a dozen times. The seventh time, he, on the verge of slitting his throat with a razor, cried, "Oh, I am greatly disappointed." But he was able to gather his senses. He continued contemplating Dhamma and finally became an arahant. Of course, this is just a brief sketch of his story. When he passed away, all the great Maharas came and sought for his departed citta. As we might say, they left no stone unturned, but were still unsuccessful in their search. Little did they know where he went to take birth again. The Lord Buddha said this to them, "In no way, either by digging, searching, investigating, or turning over the ground, would you find the departed citta of Gotika, the son of the Tathagata, and an accomplished one. It is beyond the range and means of Samuti. So how could you ever find it? It is beyond the ability of people with kilesas to know the power of the Arahant's citta. Nobody in the realm of Samuti can trace the whereabouts of the Arahant's citta, because they have already departed from Samuti, even though their cittas are similar to ours. Try to investigate and see it for yourself. When we consistently and relentlessly cleanse our citta, which is now unstable, it will become increasingly subtle via this effort, and subsequently extremely subtle. Eventually this subtlety will all disappear, because it is Samuti. Remaining is an immaculate nature comparable to pure gold, or the ultimate Dhamma, which we call the pure citta. Then our problems will all vanish, like those of the Arahants, for our citta is now as supreme as theirs, already gone beyond. This type of citta can be realized by both men and women. So far as the sexes are concerned, they are one form of Samuti. The citta, however, is sexless. Men and women can be equally competent and skillful with Dhamma. They can attain to succeeding levels of Dhamma, all the way to Vimutti, freedom. In this respect, they are unimpeded by anything. What we need are sufficient levels of skill, power, and vasana, virtue accumulated in the past, because this will enable us to cross over. Therefore, we must try to train and develop our citta. At very least, we should try for the state of calm and coolness. By using any effective Dhamma that succeeds in making the citta calm, the result will be a cool and happy heart. The particular device that we use will be the controlling agent, the refuge and anchor of the citta, especially anapanasati, mindfulness of in and out breathing, which is an important gamatana subject within the circle of practice. Anapanasati seems to be the Dhamma which suits the character and personality of most people. It is used more widely than the other Dhammas, and we should take it to heart, so that our heart can become quiet and peaceful. When the heart enters into calm, we will begin to see its essence. begin to penetrate its nature. When the citta gathers its flow into one point and has just the knowingness manifesting within that state, this is what the Lord called the citta. The citta's degree of convergence depends on the citta's own ability, its level, and its subtlety. If the citta is still coarse, when it converges, one may still know what it is like. When it is subtle, we will know its more subtle aspects. For instance, we will know that the citta is subtle, that it is bright and clear, that it is extremely calm, that it is supremely marvelous, or that it is becoming increasingly more developed. And we also know that all this is happening to this very citta. Our object is for purity, for development and training, for calm investigation, research, and for correcting the problems of the heart with panya. These are the methods which enable the development of the citta to steadily advance and to gradually penetrate its true nature. No matter how gross the heart may be, if we persist with our effort, continue to strive and exert ourselves, this grossness will steadily disappear. The disappearance will correspond to our degree of exertion and ongoing drive. Eventually, whether man or woman, we will each pass beyond and realize freedom. We will have cut and struck down the kilesas completely, exterminating them. As long as we are still incapable of doing this, our heart should not be anxious, but instead establish a basis for itself. Then we will be our own support and refuge. We have depended on our body since birth. We all know this. We have been living with it, putting it to sleep, discharging its waste, putting it to work, and making a living with it. Each mutually uses and manipulates the other. For example, we force it to do work, and it subjects us to dukkha and pain in the various parts of the body. Then we have to go and look for medicines to cure this pain. It is this body which is afflicted with pain, and it is the one who has to find a cure. And it is the one who must pursue money and things. This is how we keep on supporting each other. It is not certain as to who has the upper hand. Is it the Dharukhanda or us? We only have temporary control over it, but it reigns over us all the time. Sickness and affliction, hunger and thirst, sleepiness and lethargy, these are dukkha which the body put us through. It has complete control of us, and we possess very little control over it. So when the time is right to force it to practice bhavana, we must really do it. When the Dharukhanda is healthy and normal, we can exert in our practice at any intensity. But when the Dharukhanda is afflicted, unhealthy, and abnormal, we must know what it can handle. But the exertion of the heart must go on and must not be led to sleep, because it is an essential undertaking. We have depended on this body for ages. Now that it is ailing and malfunctioning, we should face facts. We should know its capacity for work, because we are its possessor. We have to reduce and relax accordingly. The heart, however, is not a afflicted as the body is. Therefore, it should intensify its internal exertion, so that it doesn't miss out on the benefit to be gained. We must develop a principle for the heart. While we live with a basis. When we die with a basis. Wherever we take birth, we should live with a sound principle that keeps us happy and contented. The goodness and virtue which we look forward to should not be allowed to go astray. We should always have things that bring us satisfaction and contentment. This will accord with our practice for the development of good and virtue. That is, the happiness sought by all people, and which people are never satiated with. Such is the nature of happiness, always wanted in any form, especially the heart's happiness arising from cultivating good and virtue, as from the practice of bhavana. Such happiness is the core, the important essence of the heart. We should therefore cultivate it while the dhatukhanda lives. Once we reach the end of life, development will be beyond our capacity. However much or little we have achieved, we must stop at that time. Then we are laid off and retired from our job to await its result in the next stage, over there in the next life. Over there. We should do whatever we can. If we can pass beyond and realize freedom, then all our problems and troubles will be entirely taken care of. Nothing to bother and involve us anymore. Here we are talking about the citta, which is preeminent, and which can lead us to good or evil, happiness or suffering. Nothing but the citta can produce these things. Karma and its result are both in the citta. The citta is their creator. It makes no difference whether we remember them or not. And because karma's agent is in the heart, its consequences cannot be blocked. It is deeply rooted in the citta. We must accept the consequences of our karma, but we shouldn't blame anyone else. What we did is already done. Why blame anything? When we write with our hand, we must use our own hand to rub it out. We should accept it like a sportsman. Such is the way with karma. When we have realized freedom, then all our troubles will disappear.